Okay. Today, because we have these two different case studies that are complementary but not exactly the same, we've got a couple pre-planned questions before we turn it over to the audience in our usual fashion. So, Richard Dan, we talked a bit about, you know, the government subsidy, which clearly had a role here. Can the government buy its way to food security? How much do you think the level of the government intervention mattered to the levels of adoption that you examined?
Sure. I think the short answer is yes. As I said, they went from deficits and crises in a few drought years in the mid and early 2000s to being quote-unquote net exporters of maize after 2010 or 11. That said, and this wasn't the purpose of my study, so I didn't do the math, but I'd be willing to bet, and maybe there's somebody online from Michigan State who've done the math, because they've done a lot of work. Great. By the way, I should have mentioned that a lot of, even though I did a lot of field research, Michigan State has been putting out a huge number of extremely important studies for many years now that are absolutely invaluable and really have been a fantastic investment of resources. That if they had been purchasing that on the open market, they probably could have done so, I bet, at half the price. They were, for many years, paying well above international maize prices. And as I mentioned, when they ended up with all this extra maize, they had no storage capacity, so a lot of it's rotted. I don't know the numbers, but you hear people talk about 20, 30, 40% has, and then they dump the rest on the international market. They were paying, I heard, something like over $300, $350 a ton at points, and we're selling it at $150 a ton. So that's not so from the economics. And now I understand, and you know, we could have a huge debate about it, that it isn't just about the money, that these countries and governments, for understandable political, I mean, you can't get elected or stay in political power in Zambia without making sure there's enough maize for two reasons. Zambia is one of the most urbanized countries in southern Africa. Only 60% of the population is in rural areas. And if you don't have maize for those people to eat, you're in big doo-doo. And as I mentioned, for the urban rural population, 99% of smallholders grow maize. So for them, politically, it was a win-win to, on the one hand, provide subsidized inputs and buy the maize from the smallholders and make sure they were growing it, and on the other hand, make sure that there was cheap maize available for urban consumers. The economics were terrible, and they now have a huge problem, which maybe Dan can pick up in terms, because they're trying some new things on the input side. Whether they can do that politically or not remains to be seen. And so the question, I think, is more about, yes, you can do it, but is it sustainable financially? And also, if my graphs were still up there, you notice the yields were going down. Well, the fact that the yields have been really bad in the last 2 or 3 years, you may remember that I mentioned that the yield bumps were only 20, 30%. Well, actually, the last couple of years, the margins were sufficiently small, even with the subsidies, that the farmers have not made money. And a lot of the farmers I talked to in the most rural areas not this season, but the 2014-2015 season actually lost money, which is pushing them towards drought-tolerant maize and short-cycle maize, but they are not sure how much longer the ones that are in more remote areas or in more unfavorable ecological zones can continue to produce maize, even with the government support.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's fundamentally a political question, right? But if you have the funding, you can coordinate these. I mean, it's a capacity question, but a fiscal question first off. I mean, I think that it's indisputable, like Richard said, that there's a correlation. I mean, Zambia far outpaces its neighbors in terms of smallholder adoption of improved maize, and that is almost one to one correlated with the existence of the subsidy program. There's a lot of other distortions in the subsidy program as well, aside from the ones that Richard mentioned. I mean, there has been, when it was based on a simple paper voucher scheme, a really large secondary market that popped up across the country where you were provided basically a 50% coupon to take to your local agri dealer, and poorer farmers who really needed the money would then sell those at 40 cents on the dollar to slightly wealthier farmers who would just collect a larger bundle. So it ended up becoming a bit of a regressive subsidy through the secondary market mechanism. And they're trying to get, there are some workarounds that are kind of interesting that they're using to get around that. They have piloted last season, primarily in Southern Province and Parrier and Lusaka, an e-voucher scheme that would provide a debit card that was tied to someone's national identification number that they could only redeem at certified agri-dealer shops. So it was also acting as a quality control mechanism for making sure that, you know, if you're going to be participating in this scheme, you have to get audited and certified that you're not selling counterfeit inputs, that you're otherwise providing a baseline of quality to the farmer customers. And that pilot seems like it's gone very well. I haven't seen the data yet. It should be coming out fairly soon. And they're now this year actually looking to scale that up to over 600,000 farmers across, I think, an additional 13 districts or 15 districts in the country, and trying to expand that now to become eventually a standard certification for any agro-dealer that wants to work nationwide.
If I could just come back in on one very important point, and I do not work for Michigan State and have never worked for Michigan State, but Michigan State did a very important study on the social impact of the input subsidy program. And one of the key things that the government of Zambia has done persistently is they explicitly did not see this as an anti-poverty program, particularly the input subsidy. They saw it as targeting emerging farmers. And there isn't a strict definition of emerging farmer in terms of land size. Land size is very complicated in Zambia because it's one of the few countries where there's excess land, and often farmers have more land than they actually cultivate. But the criterion principle was farmers that had a commercial orientation. And so even though smallholders are often defined as less than 2 hectares or less than 5 hectares, the fact of the matter is that FISP did not go to the bottom 40% of farmers in terms of size. And so the Michigan State study shows that, again, depends on, I think we're finding this pretty consistently, that just like we've discovered with microfinance, that actually microfinance doesn't help the poorest of the poor, it helps the poor. A lot of these in the Zambian case, even the input study helps smallholder farmers, but not the smallest of the smallholder farms.
Which brings us to the next question. How convenient. What do these cases tell us about the tension between commercial pathways to food security and the ability to reach the poorest?
Yeah, this is just building on what Richard was saying. This has been a core issue. It's a core issue we're still grappling with in the current project. I think it's definitely something that comes out of the learning here, which is that back in the early 2000s, you really did have this bifurcated agricultural sector where you had these large-scale commercial farms, and then you had, at least from a government perspective and from a private sector perspective, they just looked at everybody else who would be producing on less than 10 hectares. But at this point, we have a far more nuanced range of production systems, and I think you're having, in a lot of these areas, the kinds of standard emergent class formation that you get anywhere that's moving into a market system away from what it was essentially subsistence production for so long. I think the short answer is that commercially oriented agriculture and increasing commercialization is never going to be a pathway out of poverty for the poorest of the poor as producers or as entrepreneurs. I think we like to, it's nice to think of it that way, but there's entrepreneurship in the way that it exists here, and then there's entrepreneurship because you can't find a job and you're simply trying to scrape together as much cash as you can, and that's not necessarily the same thing. And I would say that it would be that what I am seeing in Zambia in terms of how do you reach those populations that are so much further away from any of these market access roads, where the transaction costs are still extremely high, where for the commercial input supply sector to supply even these emergent farmers, they're going to have to be hitting pretty significant tonnages per farmer to be able to really make the economics work from a purely private sector standpoint. So you're already looking at these people on the brink of becoming an emergent to commercial farmer still need to get a little bit larger than they are now for it to really be sustained by the existing market system. I think it's very much worth looking into some of these other pathways to complement this idea of agricultural entrepreneurship, in terms of employment, in terms of some of these other things that are probably in the long run going to be both more highly sought after by the poorest of the poor as a livelihood strategy, and are probably going to be more viable from an enterprise standpoint as well.
I hope that this was implicitly understood, but I just want to make it explicit that, at least for me and I think for Dan, we speak for ourselves and the studies we did enough for USAID.
Of course. So
having said that, I think there is a real tension in this between the poor and the poorest of the poor, as Dan said. And however that's defined, whether it's defined by access to financial resources, whether it's defined by land size, whether it's defined by distance from the market on the input and the output size, I mean, one of the things that we always do when we look at the crop budgets is we do sensitivity analysis. So if you up the cost of outputs by 10, 20, 30% because of transaction costs, and if you knock 10, 20, or 30% off of the prices farmers are receiving on the output side for the same reason, what effect do you get? And the margins in Zambia are sufficiently small that basically once you start to get 50 kilometers away from these markets, these are not profitable for the farmers. And if FRA wasn't out there buying the maize at good prices, they probably, well, they would still be growing because they probably grow it to eat for themselves, but they certainly wouldn't be growing it on the size or the scale or putting new land into production, which is what I alluded to. You know, I think there's a real challenge both for USAID and other donors and for their implementing partners because of the timeframes of these projects. Basically, they're trying to do two things simultaneously. They're trying to do what I would call, even though they wouldn't call it this, humanitarian assistance, which there's these really poor, tiny, smallholder farmers that will never be commercially viable. And how can we, and implementing partners are pushed to or required to try to hit some number, 30, 50,000 of the poorest of the poor. And in fact, the USAID zones of influence, the Feed the Future zones of influence, were specifically selected with very high poverty rates. And at the same time, they're also trying to use market systems and value chain approaches for which, in my personal opinion, especially in grains, they will never be profitable. At least not rain-fed, irrigated, whole separate question. We just did a study in Senegal, which I'm writing up, which that's a different story because that was all irrigated. But for rain-fed, you know, and so I think I agree 100% with Dan, which is that this, call them what you want, larger smallholder farmers, emerging farmers, etc., there's definitely a possibility of reaching them, integrating them both on the input and the output side into market systems. But the smallest of the small, I think the long-term strategy is, that's why I said this is not USAID's position, is that, you know, we know that they need to either find other rural employment or they are going to migrate out, and we see that as happening in some countries. And I think Dan's exactly right, whether it's creating alternative rural income strategies or other things, that's key. And I just want to second what he said about the importance of bundling. In Feed the Future, I think because of the way it was originally designed, and understandably so, there was a real concentration on narrowing the number of value chains that Feed the Future projects worked in. And the reason was because there had been a history of doing everything, okay? And I think we were learning now that the pendulum may have swung a little too far. Because there's been an emphasis on food insecurity, there's been emphasis on staple grains. And as Dan said, nobody can really make money unless you're doing lots of land, and particularly if you have irrigation or some sort of crop insurance, hard to make money on staple grains either as an input supplier or as a producer. But if you mix in particularly livestock, which for the input suppliers, walking around with a knapsack of veterinary medicine, the markups are huge on that, and the value to weight ratio is huge, whereas you can carry 500 pounds of maize seed and you're never going to make a living off of that, okay? So if you don't get the right bundles and start thinking about this from a whole different perspective, not how do we achieve scale in maize seed and food security, but how do we create a market system where everybody's making money and as part of that try to achieve food security, we're going to have serious and continue to have serious problems in achieving the goals.